Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine's podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to always do your own reading around the topics we discuss. Enjoy!
Hello everybody and welcome to our SAM podcast. Today we're going to talk about a subject that is exciting me somewhat, is hypertension. It's exciting me because it's something that I'm quite passionate about because it's often not done that well, and I get really frustrated when I pick up patients in a waiting room who've been there for 10 hours after their stat of amlodipine. So we're going to cover a few different things, but before we do that, I'm going to introduce who we've got with us today. So regular listeners, if we've got any, will know Damien.
Hi, Vicky. Thanks for this. I, too, have a big interest in hypertension. I'm currently trying to write our guideline at the moment, and it's proven difficult. So hopefully after today, I'm going to learn loads more.
And be enthused as well.
Very.
But I don't think we could do this without some experts in the field, could we?
True.
So that's who we brought along today. So we've got, first of all, Anna. Anna is a consultant at the Royal Liverpool Hospital and is a clinical pharmacologist and has an interest in hypertension. Hi, Anna.
Hi, everyone.
And we've also got Ben Cross. And Ben is a doctor at the Royal Liverpool Hospital who has put in painstaking hours of work to actually write a pathway, which is absolutely brilliant and finally got everybody agreeing on it, for the management of hypertension at the Royal Liverpool, both for ambulatory management and also for the emergency management as well. So surprisingly, you're still smiling, Ben, despite all that hard work. Do you want to say hello and introduce yourself?
Hi.
Lovely. Okay. Right. So with no further ado, what we thought we'd do today, Damien, is go through three cases, just covering slightly different aspects of what we see. So how about I start with that first case that tends to drive me up the wall a bit, because we get somebody who's been referred in, and in this case, their blood pressure is not that high. So perhaps they've even come in with something completely unrelated. Let's say it's a female who is 32 who's come in having had an insect bite, and she's got quite nasty cellulitis on her left leg. Can be the right, doesn't matter. While she's in the waiting room, somebody does her blood pressure and it's 100 over 80. So we can deal with the blood pressure, as we can deal with the cellulitis quite nicely, but we note this blood pressure and we're a bit worried.
Do you mean a bit higher than 100 over 80?
I mean 180 over 80. I mean, 100 over 80 puts us in a whole different ballpark, doesn't it? No. Yes, I do. Thank you, David, as ever. So she's got cellulitis, but she's also got blood pressure, and she's a young woman at 32. So who do I start with? Shall I start with Ben?
Okay.
So we can deal with the cellulitis. What are we going to do about this blood pressure? Because that's what everybody's flapping about.
So I think the first thing is obviously to repeat it.
Yeah.
Not a great environment to try and calm people down is waiting in A&E. People obviously tend to stay het up, and if anything, get more het up as the longer they wait.
Yeah.
But ideally, it's meant to be a kind of calm, quiet environment. Leave them to sit for sort of half an hour or so and then repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
What I like to do is ask people for a manual blood pressure, because it'll take at least sort of half an hour to find a manual cuff. and then you can believe the blood pressure you'll get there.
Okay. So let's say we repeat it half an hour later, Anna, and it comes back and it's 175 over 75.
Okay. And we've confirmed that, so in this case, it's measured with the correct cough size for this patient, and she sat there with a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's probably important to note at this point that she's not ill, as in she's not septic. The cellulitis is something we would give a bit of oral antibiotic to. So it's not, we're not concerned that she's massively unwell. So what do we do at this point?
And this patient isn't known to have hypertension, obviously.
No, not at all. And let's make it even better, she was adopted.
Well, if this patient is clinically well, and we've done whatever baseline test we've done for her cellulitis, and there's no sort of signs of any end organ damage or anything to suggest that this is in any patient is in any way compromised from this blood pressure, she sat there quite happily with no other symptoms apart from her cellulitis, then it wouldn't be someone that we would be urgently needing to treat for her blood pressure. We would be treating her for while she's in hospital for her cellulitis and managing that. And I think we would need to consider whether this patient maybe might have an underlying diagnosis of hypertension. Mm-hmm. But if that's not what she's initially presented with, there's no rush to treat this hypertension. She's certainly not in a hypertensive crisis. And if it's 175 over
75,
yeah, so she's not technically hypertensive urgency either, but she's certainly got no end-on damage. This is a patient who possibly could have hypertension, but it wouldn't be something you would diagnose off two blood pressure readings in the ED.
Okay.
So can I ask, you mentioned baseline tests and end organ damage. What would we be looking for at the front door? What type of things would we send? What investigations would we do to know that?
Well, we probably wouldn't be specifically, you know, be doing these tests initially on a patient with cellulitis. It'd just be what happened to maybe have a set of UNEs and you'd be reassured that her renal function was normal. In patients who do present and you want to exclude end organ damage, you'd obviously be looking at a baseline ECG, full blood count, UNEs, and a urine dipstick would be kind of ones that I'd be looking at initially, easy ones to do if someone comes into GPIU. Then a face on your clinical examination as well as alongside the investigations, you'd be wanting to quite soon rule out that this patient has any evidence of a hypertensive sort of emergency.
So should we talk about the other thing that I don't think you mentioned, but looking at the back of the eyes and fendoscopy?
Mm-hmm.
Should we do that?
So I think it's would be quite a good time to discuss that. So mm-hmm. Ben put together this brilliant pathway, and one of the first things is to do fendoscopy. And I'll share a little story from our experience, which was really quite funny, because pathways always have unintended consequences. And the first point of the pathways was just to make sure there was no grade 3 or 4 retinopathy. And what happened was I got quite an angry email from the ophthalmologist because we're getting loads of patients traipsing around to the ophthalmology department for urgent fendoscopy because nobody trusted themselves to look in the back of the eyes. And then that led on to a whole new thing, which actually we realised that lots of people are really frightened now to look in the back of the eyes and don't trust what they're seeing. And it feels like it's a bit of a dying skill. And I know there's a lot of stuff in neurology as well that neurologists get frustrated that we're not looking in the back of the eyes. So as well as doing this pathway, we also have to do a bit of a sideline in teaching people how to use a fundoscope again.
But it isn't something we do every day.
So it is something I tend to do every day now. I think I'm unusual.
On the wards, so if you're doing, say, a ward round, would you always look at
the eyes? So as an acute medic doing the acute take, I probably, yes.
Yeah, we probably do it a lot more.
But I suppose, yeah, for the ward doctors, do they do it every day? It's a good question. It caused a lot of debate because a lot of my colleagues felt that they had de-skilled as well. What do you two think?
I mean, fendoscopy is a kind of old school way of grading hypertension, really. Yeah. So I personally think looking at back of the eyes is pretty useful in for a lot of medical things. It's not very often you can see kind of a end organ arterial supply to give you that kind of information, but obviously technically challenging, especially in AME and AMU environments with bright lights, can't turn the lights out, curtains is all you can do really, and often finding the equipment to do it is a big problem. I think I've got better at it since I bought a kind of pocket fundoscope.
Yeah.
And just kind of doing it more and more. And dilating eyes is much better. So one of the things I thought about when I wrote the pathway was to make sure that I wrote how to dilate eyes. Because I think people also feel underconfident dilating eyes, especially from the kind of the medical side. I think A&E feel a lot more confident with it. But if you've just kind of done some general medical ward jobs, you probably never come across dilating eyes.
Trying to find where the drops are as well.
This is all playing in well to Ben's point earlier about trying to find a manual BP cup and then send them to find tropicamide and a fundoscope that actually works. You'll probably get 4 hours in a dark room. Anna, have you got any strong feelings about fundoscopy?
I think it's a good skill to sort of try and improve at if you feel that you're maybe not as good at it or you're lacking in confidence, maybe it's been a few years since your paces. I think it is an important thing to just keep having a go and look at as many eyes as you can. I think it is important in this sort of, certainly in our pathway and in the management of acute hypertensive crisis, I think it is important to rule out just grade 3 and grade 4 and retinopathy, because it's really looking at that end organ effect in the back of the eye. And it's sort of, I'd say it's quite important certainly here to categorise patients and really risk stratify them.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's looking for the big stuff.
Yeah.
You're not looking for the tiny detail. You're looking for the big papilledema or the big hemorrhages.
I guess the caveat to that is, and what did come up when one of the many meetings I had for the pathway was, well, what do you do if you see someone who's got grade 3 hypertension, they've got papilledema, but they've got no renal disorder, the heart's fine. What do you do then? Because it's potentially just chronic, especially if you've got an ECG that's got LVH.
So what do you do then, Ben?
Well, good question. I think general consensus was you don't know. You don't know, is this like a malignant hypertension, is this rapidly changing or not? Mm-hmm. So our suggestion was that you kind of just admit them overnight and then just repeat their unis and in the morning and just check that you've not kind of got any new end organ damage. Obviously, then if you started to develop rapidly changing end organ damage, then you've got kind of definitive diagnosis. It's worth saying as well, it's worth telling patients with grade 3 hypertension to go to the opticians when they're discharged to kind of get proper retinal images, and then you can avoid kind of getting that chronic, oh, I've got papilledema, but no one's ever seen it before.
Yeah.
I do think at some hospitals, though, we do have possibly too easy access to ophthalmology when they come in, whereas in other hospitals, it's
you
not as easy.
You have to look at the eyes.
Yeah.
Can't just send them around the corner.
And I'm the same as Ben. I've got a pocket fundoscope.
Yeah, so I have, and I love it, and I find it easier to use than the ones in the hospital. I get better images. It apparently mine attaches to my phone as well, so I can take a picture, but I'm not clever enough to work out how to do that yet, but I will.
Pretty sure I told you that.
Yeah. So if you did admit them with the grade 3-4, would you just put them on oral? Because we're not going to treat it as a malignant if they're otherwise really well.
Yeah, so it's difficult, but I think you probably would go oral.
Yeah, because then you could send them home legitimately the next morning, couldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. And treating blood pressure aggressively isn't without risk.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the key things, that it's just essentially a number if you've not got any end organ damage. So the eyes are just an early warning sign that something might be going on.
And like you say, it could be chronic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to our lady who goes home with her cellulitis, and we follow her up in ambulatory care. Maybe it's a very keen ambulatory care unit, but it's just convenient for this particular discussion we're having, because she's only 32 and she's been really good and she's done a diary. And this is usually the kind of thing I'm sure that the GPs would be dealing with, but if we come across this and maybe it was a bit higher, or we've got a 32-year-old here, is there other things we should be doing? Because this seems unusual in a 32-year-old who's got blood pressure. So as well as all the baseline tests you were talking about before, what next, and how should you have a criteria for who would refer to a specialist, that sort of thing?
Yeah, no, definitely. So certainly in an under 40 year old patient, like you describe, this is sort of early onset hypertension. This patient needs investigated for secondary causes. And certainly that's in our pathway, it's on the NICE guidelines. And we would be looking to do a panel of investigations for secondary screening in this patient. And ambulatory care can initiate and send the investigations off. They do take time to come back, and then I'd be happy to see this sort of patient in our clinic to follow up these investigations. We'd be looking at things like sending plasma methadrenalins, retinaldosterone levels, and booking this patient an echocardiogram as well to review in the clinic, look for any obvious secondary causes, and we'd book this patient a renal ultrasound as well. And depending on what medication we start this patient on, if we are planning on starting this patient on medication with confirmed hypertension following her home blood pressure monitoring, we'd be looking to repeat her UNEs as well, following the introduction of, say, an ACE inhibitor as well.
Perfect, yeah. And you use a cutoff of 40. Just distressing me, does that
mean? We're definitely not so strict.
But
there is suspicion of, secondary causes in other individuals as well.
Yeah, I'm just feeling a bit old, that's all. There's so many guidelines where under 40 are young and over 40, that's it.
Especially if you're running, sorry, if you run into the realms of, you know, this is a, you know, stage 3 hypertension presenting with a hypertensive crisis.
Yeah.
Who's never had a diagnosis of hypertension before would also be wanting to, you know, use our...
Yeah, clinical judgment a bit there, isn't it? Okay.
So can I change it up then?
Yeah, change it up, okay. Damien. Let's move on to
so
new
case. How about instead of being in her 30s, how about this lady was in her 80s? She had a bit of CKD, and she came in with the same blood pressure. What would you do differently, if anything?
Yeah, so blood pressure off, was it 180 over?
180 over 80.
180 over 80, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a patient who's not previously known to have hypertension, but perhaps hasn't had a blood pressure check for several years. Is it on any antihypertensives? So it would probably be, our approach would probably be different. It's more likely that this patient has an essential hypertension. Certainly we wouldn't be rushing to do sort of secondary screening in patients over 80. And again, we'd be doing the same, we'd be assessing this patient for end organ effects, and then we'd be taking our time to decide on management, whether this patient doesn't need to stay in hospital, they've got no signs of end organ damage, we could follow them up with our ambulatory or with the GP.
So that's fairly straightforward, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So should we go to a new case?
Go for it.
Do you want to go?
Oh, it's my turn. Okay. So how about we make the blood pressure a bit higher? So this patient referred in by the GP, no past medical history, but their blood pressure is sitting at 200 over 110. They don't have any symptoms. They're well. How would you work this one up that's different to the previous two cases?
Because this is really common, isn't it, in ambulatory care or SDEC. You see patients who've gone for a well-man check or a well-woman check or something completely, and the blood pressure's over 180 or 100, over 120 diastolic. And they get rushed in, and they get really worked up as well because they get told that the blood pressure is frighteningly high, and they might have a bleed, and then they sit in our waiting room, and
the blood pressure stays at 200 as well, so it doesn't half an hour and changing the cuffs, it's still high.
Yeah.
So what do we do now?
So we're going to go back to the patient again, history examination, thinking about doing some investigations to obviously rule out again any signs of end organ damage, but we'd be looking at the patient straight away, and we'd just do those investigations we discussed before, Damien. So we'd be checking the UNEs, assessing the renal function, getting the baseline ECG. It's important that we assess blood pressure in both arms as well, just to have a look and consider that as well. Do a urine dipstick. So as a clinician now, I've done the investigations, I'm pretty reassured that this patient doesn't have or any evidence of end organ damage. I'll let Ben discuss how we've sort of addressed this on our sort of ambulatory pathway.
Yeah, so in this case, the patient's well. So the decision is that they can just go home, essentially. We've got a couple of...
But Ben, do we not give them 5 milligrams of amlodipine, make them wait for 4 hours in the waiting room until it drops below 200 because everything changes at 199? Are we wrong?
And because amlodipine works that quickly.
It does, doesn't
well,
it? Amlodipine is instant.
I'm not against starting amlodipine. I am against making them wait, though. So people with hypertension, there's no indication to bring it down quickly, especially people with very high blood pressures. If you drop the blood pressure very fast, you're at risk of strokes, MIs because of it. So the emphasis from kind of Europe and the UK is that essentially it should just be brought down over weeks to months. So amlodipine is fine. I prefer lercanidipine. You get less peripheral edema, but both are fine. Europe have a bit more of an aggressive strategy, and they generally start people on combination tablets for hypertension. So they often use an ACE inhibitor with a calcium channel blocker from the get-go, which I think is quite good. But certainly don't need to wait around waiting for it to come down. The best thing, the key thing is just to follow them up in a timely manner. In the pathway, again, after lots of meetings, deciding on how to risk stratify people, we went for a strategy based on things that are predictors of doing badly from having really high blood pressures. So we consider people who are high risk if they had heart failure, for example, or if they had really advanced CKD, or if they're over 75. We used a standard follow-up time for people of 2 weeks. That was generally chosen to catch patients' renal deterioration if they were started on an ACE inhibitor. But for these higher risk people, we decided that following them up in a week was the best option. And that, again, is mainly just to check for end organ damage and just check things aren't rapidly progressing.
So what would you do in a week's time? Would it just be a simple UNE, an ECG, anything different?
Yeah, so I guess you should probably repeat fundoscopy. It's non-invasive, check things aren't developing
good
from
practice.
That point of view. Good practice, exactly. But the key things is just, yeah, repeat the blood pressure, repeat the UNE. Things like ECG probably aren't going to change things, because what you're looking for in the ECG is you're looking for LVH, and that won't have progressed over a week, or I certainly hope not anyway. So if you rule out the kidneys being a problem, then it's just kind of getting the number better. But because of the difficulties that GPs can sometimes have with high blood pressures in community and the lack of access to immediate tests, we suggested that we get it down below sort of 180 systolic before we send them back into the land of community health.
I suppose the other thing with GP access as well is that locally, certainly, we can't get a blood test within 3 weeks. So if we're wanting to do a fairly quick UNE, that was always the agreement that ambulatory care would step in at that point. Damien and I were being facetious a little earlier about the time it takes for amlodipine. So
yeah, I was thinking that. I was like thinking we need a bit of disclaimer.
Yeah. So
how sarcastic.
Well, it's my favourite question to ask juniors. How long does it take for amlodipine to work? Especially the juniors that have sat in the waiting room. So I've been taught, I think, it's 3 weeks to reach steady state. Is that about right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not going to work in that half an hour that we give it.
But placebo will sometimes. And that, I think that's why this is, because the best thing about this amlodipine effect. It's not just localized to one hospital. It's all over the country. Yeah. Everybody does it. And I think it's because everybody feels comfortable with amlodipine and that everybody's seen it work because somebody's given it to somebody and it's come down, but that is just the placebo. But I think it's fascinating that it's all over the country that everyone does it. Okay, lovely. And so there's quite a lot of papers about aggressively treating blood pressure being actually dangerous in the short term if you don't need to because it's an emergency. And we'll put some show notes at the on our, we'll put some references on our show notes at the end just so that people can have a look at those. Because this is the fear, isn't it? I think this is the fear that we feel even now, is that if the blood pressure is over 200 and we let them go home, what if they have a bleed or a stroke? And it's not impossible because these patients are higher risk, but actually we need to know that we're doing the right thing and there's evidence that actually if we start crashing it down too quickly, that's a bigger risk to that patient. And it's going to come down probably once they get to their own home anyway, isn't it?
I think it's just so ingrained in us, isn't it, to chase the numbers, especially if you're admitting patients. The evidence is that people do worse, medical patients, for non-cardiac reasons if you adjust their antihypertensives as an inpatient. But how many ward rounds would you be on that people would feel comfortable with someone sat there with a blood pressure of 190 every day without doing anything?
Yeah.
I don't think many.
I think that's a really good point. And I think that's why actually having a pathway in a hospital is so helpful for juniors and seniors, because actually if it's been approved properly and it's following national or international guidance, then actually you can feel that bit more comfortable that you're doing the right thing.
Because there is that fear of criticism. If you need to discharge people as a junior with high blood pressures, and then it's that fear of criticism.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Are we happy with everything on that case?
I think so. So,
basically, don't wait for it to go below 200. There is no magic number. Okay.
So then moving on to patient who has been referred in, chest pain, shortness of breath, and their blood pressure is 220 over 120. So
do they look ill?
But they do.
Are they in ambulatory care? We've moved them to research.
Probably are, but you're swiftly moving them in the trolley into a more monitored area.
Sure.
But they do look a lot more unwell. And the blood pressure is a lot higher, and now they have symptoms, which is very different to the previous cases that we've had.
Mm.
How do we approach that?
So this patient's got chest pain, they've got shortness of breath.
They look awful.
They look unwell, yeah.
Mm. Sweaty. It's not that common, is it, that we see this? I'm just thinking as sort of...
And it's not that easy just to approach as just, this could be a simple hypertension, obviously.
Yeah.
Think about everything else as well.
Everything,
But if we do think this is all just a hypertensive emergency that we're forgetting all the other things? How would we approach this as a hypertensive emergency?
I guess with chest pain, you've got to kind of forget about what the numbers are and just think about what's the driving factor here. So is this a dissection? Is this a hypertensive MI? Two big ones in those scenarios. So you're just going to want to do some more imaging essentially on these people, kind of ASAP really.
What imaging would you suggest? Would it be putting you on the spot? I know.
I guess it depends on your clinical history and examination, but if you're worried about dissection, it needs to be a CT aorta. If hypertensive MI, I guess you could do CT coronaries if you're in a centre that does that as part of their kind of initial screening. Some places do, but you know, things like an ECG then will be really useful. And in both cases, getting the blood pressure down quickly would definitely be the preferred option.
And how do we do that? How do we get the blood pressure down? Some have a lot of pain again, I'm guessing.
So this patient has evidence of end organ damage or hypertensive emergency. We're guided by the treatment is depending on which organ is affected, whether this is a dissection, it's got very specific management, or of a sort of pulmonary acute cardiac pulmonary edema, or whether the patient's had a myocardial infarction. Ultimately,
so it's not easy then.
We're wanting to move this patient to a high dependency area, make sure this patient is in the appropriate setting to manage his blood pressure based on whatever organ or end organ effects we need to manage.
I think the key thing in terms of drug selection is generally you normally think, the Betalol works for everything, but hypertensive MIs and hypertensive heart failure, you should be avoiding the Betalol because the risk of kind of circulatory collapse. So opting for things like GTN would be much better and will also probably help with the chest pain as well.
Okay. And I'm just thinking about the other things then. So in terms of, say you've got normal ECG, let's maybe take the chest pain out of it a bit, but the kidney function has gone off. What would you be looking at then in terms of treatment-wise?
And they've got protein in the urine.
Yeah.
They always have protein in the urine.
Yeah.
So in terms of, if you think it's kind of a hypertensive renal crisis, you obviously want to involve the renal team early on.
Yeah.
They sometimes like to use different drugs, a lot fancier things that kind of vasodilate the blood supply to kidneys a bit more. But things like labetalol and GTN would both be options for these patients. You potentially wouldn't have to be quite so aggressive in terms of you wouldn't necessarily need to get it down sort of now. So if you've got a dissection, you know, within an hour, you want it below sort of 140 systolic. But someone with a hypertensive renal crisis, you might want to wait, sort of aim to get it down slowly, sort of 25% in the first 2 to 6 hours.
So I guess the key take home for these hypertensive emergencies then is these patients are sick. They're likely to deteriorate. They need management quickly. So probably get intensive care involved fairly quickly. If we do know what the diagnosis is, then get the specialties from that particular specialty involved quickly. And I guess we haven't mentioned pregnancy and eclampsia. That's a totally different podcast, I think. But if they're pregnant, obviously we would involve the obstetricians.
I'm sure it's different management as well.
Yes,
but, and it's one to know that the guidelines for anybody who's not pregnant is different to pregnant patients.
It's probably worth saying that if you're a young woman with hypertension, that if you're going to start an ACE inhibitor, you should counsel them on the risks.
Yeah.
And
about
kind of stopping that if they're trying to get pregnant and think of other things like labetalol as medication options instead.
I went to a fabulous talk on one of the SAM conferences, I think it was SAM London, where there was an obstetrician, and they were saying the higher risk women are always the women that don't go to the GP. So the people who have got complications but are involved with their GP will tell their GP they're going to get pregnant and get all the pre-pregnancy counselling. The women that we really need to worry about are the women with chaotic lifestyles, and the only health professionals they tend to come into contact with are in AMU or ED, or then the wards. So actually it's a really good opportunity if you've got women of childbearing age to actually talk to them about, you know, have you thought about getting pregnant? Are you on contraception? And if they've got something like blood pressure, to mention it then, which we think isn't really our role, but actually it turned it on the head for a bit for me, and it's changed my practice since. I thought that was a really good point. So yeah, definitely if they've you can do it for that specific thing, but you can do it for anything in a woman of childbearing age, can't you?
And other than pregnancy, the other, there's quite a lot of other conditions that can cause hypertension. We've talked about scleroderma, which is obviously a big topic that we were not going to be able to cover today. And another one that I had a nice talk today from one of our SHOs who gave a talk on a pheochromocytoma, which obviously needs to be treated differently as well to what we've talked about.
Getting those specialty people involved, isn't it? And I think there's a few, this doesn't happen very often. And a specialty consultant, even if it's out of hours, I don't think would be, who's on call, not just your random mate, wouldn't mind being phoned, because these are tricky problems and you want the very best sort of advice, don't you?
I think a lot of it's recognition as well, isn't it? So things like hypertensive encephalopathy is often not at the front of everyone's mind. So if you've got someone who's got kind of low GCS with a high blood pressure, everyone's just thinking stroke. But if you've not got any kind of focal symptoms that suggest stroke and their CT head's normal, I'm not sure everyone would be thinking you still have to be quite aggressive with the blood pressure and that claim.
Is this hypertensive? That's a very good point. So is it time to sum up, do you think, Damien?
I think so, yeah, because it's a big topic and we could be here all night talking about this.
So I guess the things for me were actually just watching you go through this, Ben, putting a pathway together. I've done a fair few ambulatory pathways. It's turned into a lot more than that. But the difference with this one is that it involves so many different specialties and getting an agreement and how many meetings you had and how I'm trying to get people to agree. It was hard work. So well done. But yeah, definitely worthwhile. And, you know, people are picking this up all the time and it's definitely changing management. So I think having a hypertension pathway is hugely helpful, and also helpful if unfortunately things do go wrong, which they may. If you send a patient home with high blood pressure, it's nice that you followed the pathway. So definitely. What's your sort of take home, Damien?
Well, I think a lot of moving, talking about the guidelines that you said, there's a lot of hospitals that I've been to that doesn't have guidelines in hypertension, not simple ones anyway. And looking at NICE guidelines, they're okay. But when you go down the route of malignant hypertensions, it's not very clear. You've got European guidance as well, which gives you a list of multiple different drugs that you can use in multiple different conditions. And that's still not very easy when you're in the middle of an on-call situation or an overnight situation. You want something nice and easy. So the other thing as well, obviously, that this is currently at the hospital that you're working at, and I may potentially steal it. So there's nothing wrong with asking bigger hospitals that you're beside or work beside to lend pathways. And there should be a bit of a link between hospitals as well and different trust, different deaneries as well to share pathways and share learning as well.
So I think that's a bigger point. So certainly with the work that Sam QI are doing, is talking about sharing resources and pathways and things. So I've been certainly very keen to sort of share resources and also get resources from other trusts. One of the first things I did when I'm trying to write a pathway is see what else is out there that's open access. Because we should be sharing good practice, shouldn't we? And to be honest, it should be standardised really as much as possible. Ben, if you were going to give us some top tips or some fun anecdotes, what would you?
I guess writing the pathway kind of made me think about how I manage hypertension, and just being aware that you need to get out of bad habits, like just chasing blood pressures for no reason, and trying your best not to adjust people's antihypertensives when they're inpatients. It's difficult, but you just got to kind of stick to your guns, and that's kind of where the evidence base is, that it's kind of this is a chronic disease for the outpatient setting when they're in their own environment to adjust things really. And also it just kind of made me aware of how many hypertensive emergencies there are, and then to kind of keep them on my radar. Like, you know, if you do get a hypertensive MI, even if they've got sort of a STEMI on their ECG, there's a good chance that the cardiologist will advise you just to treat the blood pressure first if it's kind of rapidly progressing. And see what happens, really. So it was definitely a learning book for me.
So I can still remember, this is when I show my age, isn't it? So I can still remember being a house officer, patient with a ST elevation MI. And in those days, it was thrombolysis or nothing, or aspirin. basically. And this patient had massive blood pressure. And the consultant cardiologist recommended sublingual nifedipine. And the patient didn't do very well, as you can imagine, because one minute they had a blood pressure of 220 and the next minute it's about 80. So, yeah, and then I don't know if it's been banned, but you certainly can't get it anywhere, can you, sublingual nifedipine anymore? Yeah.
It is nice though when you're in ITU and the patient has an arterial line in.
Yeah.
And you're just gonna spray GTN onto the tongue and all of a sudden you just watch the arterial line coming down. That is quite a nice thing to watch. It does go back up again eventually, yeah. But still. It's nice to see that it does work.
So Anna?
Yeah, no, it's just really to say that the vast majority of patients who present to a hospital setting with poorly controlled hypertension do not need to be in hospital, and that they can be appropriately managed sort of in a primary care or, as we've discussed, in our pathway and ambulatory setting. And if someone presents with severe hypertension, we've always got time to think, really. And in a lot of these scenarios we've discussed, there isn't a massive amount of evidence base in clinical trials, obviously, in randomizing people who present in hypertensive crisis. It's really based on our body of sort of clinical judgment and what's well established. In terms of management, certainly we discuss malignant hypertension in patients who have, say, just evidence of grade 3 or grade 4 retinopathy. It was something that was difficult to manage in our pathway. What are we going to do? Are we going to keep these patients in for a period of observation, or are we comfortable sending them home? I think it's just sort of reaching that consensus that there's not evidence for everything. So it's kind of just risk weighing up the risks and the benefits and the harm to the patient. We think that was sort of a sensible approach that we came to with those patients, to keep them in for 24 hours and observe and certainly reassess things.
Yeah, and in terms of patients who've got high blood pressure we send home, they don't all need to go to your clinic, do they?
No, we don't need to see everyone sort of in a secondary care hypertension clinic. A lot of these patients use do a really good job of turning them around, appropriately titrating them on their meds and discharging back to the GP. We'd really just be wanting to see the patients who are young. We say under 40, but obviously with your experience, you use a clinical judgment. If you're really worried about someone, you suspect a secondary cause, we will be happy to see them as well. We do also see patients, you know, who have resistant hypertension, so on 3 or more medications, and it's still not adequately controlled. That's probably other patients that we generally see more from primary care referrals.
Can I add in there as well about one thing that we never mentioned, and it's probably on the guideline, is making sure that we check compliance of patients.
We should have been point number one.
That we don't, so that we don't refer them when they're on the 4th or 5th, 6th medication.
Yeah, definitely.
When they're not actually taking them.
Yeah.
So it's always checking compliance, which is always a big thing to do for all illnesses.
And there are blood tests. I mean, they may not be available in every hospital, but there are blood tests that you can do to look for that, aren't there? So that helps rather than a trial of bringing them into hospital, as used to be the case.
Yeah, definitely.
I enjoyed that. That was a good episode. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I don't think so. I've got my learning points there. I still think I need to do a lot more fundoscopy than I probably do, but I will be carrying my fundoscope around in my pocket now, so I get better at it. But yeah, no, I feel I can. I'll be able to look after these patients a bit better now.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much, Ben. Thank you, Anna. We'll put some show notes on as usual. And see you next time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website, www.acutemedicine.org.uk, for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You will also find more information about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod and let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd like us to explore in future episodes, or if you want to get involved, we'd love you to get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you can join us next time.